Okay, I'm still experimenting with this, so not sure if I'm committed to it yet or not. One thing that's a little bit difficult is I have to change the font size so I can see it, which means I don't know whether, what? What?
Because you're 61.
I can never hear you. You say all these funny things and I can never hear you.
Because you're 61.
What? You'll be there someday. I regret all the times I made fun of old people when I was your age. But anyway, change the font. So I don't know if this sermon is 10 minutes or 10 hours. All I know is I got 112 pages according to this. So could be here a while. All right. You'll get your money's worth. Seldom do you ever get your money's worth. But all right. Well, the last five psalms have all been quite similar, as you know, in the sense that they were each a lament, at least to some degree. In one way or another, David brought before the Lord a complaint about the threats of his enemies and then called upon God to intervene. But now as we come into Psalm 8, which we are ready for today, both the theme and the tone are quite a bit different. And so the first question on your homework that you received this week should be pretty easy to answer. What kind of a psalm is this? It is a psalm of... Psalm of praise. All right, very good. In fact, of the 150 psalms in the Psalter, Psalm 8 is the first actual psalm of praise. Psalms 3 through 7 were colored by darkness and despair, suffering and contrast. We find in Psalm 8 really a commanding vision of the majestic and sovereign God who has created the universe in all of its grandeur. And in this psalm, God's glory is revealed in the awesomeness of his creation and in the fact that he has bestowed his glory on certain creatures of that creation, namely the human race. It has been said that Psalm 8 is a great example of what a hymn should be. It celebrates the glory and grace of God. It recalls who he is and what he has done. And it relates us and our world to him, all with a mastery use of carefully selected words and in a spirit of mingled joy and awe. And on top of this, it brings to light the unexpectedness of God's ways in roles that he has assigned to the strong and the weak. It begins and ends with God himself, and its overriding theme throughout is, "How excellent is thy name." The range of thought, as you read it this week, hopefully you saw this, the range of thought takes us not only above the heavens, we see that expression in verse 1, but also to, well, the ultimate question in verse 4, what is man? The adoration expressed in this psalm is reverent, it's passionate, it's intimate. The God whose glory fills the earth is our Lord. We are in covenant with him. His praise is chanted on high, and also, if you noticed, it is echoed from the cradle and the nursery. So let's read through it, and we'll actually start with the heading itself. And Nick, I'm so glad that you're here today, because last week you were complaining that I never call on you to read these scriptures, so you will not be disappointed today. There's more to the story, as you know. But if you could stand, go ahead and read through Psalm 8, and go ahead and read that heading, if you would. And you're going to read it. Is your phone like Damon's? Is it too inerrant, inspired, and infallible?
You promised you wouldn't say
anything. I did promise. It goes to show you should never trust anything I promise. All right, thanks, Nick. All right, this is the Psalter's first song of praise, we find neither an invitation to praise, you know, like, come let us worship our God sort of thing, nor a because statement providing reasons for praise, as in something like, for he is good, or he has done great things. But as you can tell when you read it, both the invitation to praise and the reason to praise are there nonetheless in a very powerful, if yet subtle way. The psalm ends in the same way it begins, identical statements. These statements serve as a literary device known as an inclusio, which is a repetition that that both opens and closes a poem. We find this in other psalms as well. This gives the psalm a sense of unity and also serves to help set the mood. Here that mood would be, of course, awe, an attitude of reverence and wonder and amazement. Between these two bookends, the first and last verses, the psalm contains three sections. In the second half of verse 1 and verse 2, God is praised for his majestic powers displayed in creation itself, in particular the wonders of the cosmos, and in the way that God uses helpless babies to fulfill his purposes. In the second section, verses 3 through 4, David wonders why such a powerful supreme deity would bother himself with mere humans. David stands beneath the wonders of the night sky and feels dwarfed by the immensity of the heavens. What is man that you would care one way or another? And then in the third section, 5 through 8, David marvels that this omnipotent God is not only mindful of humans and cares for them, but has even bestowed on them glory and honor. And this he has done by granting them authority and dominion over the other creatures that man shares the planet with. This sense of divine empowerment of humans and the responsibility that goes with that empowerment strikes David as something very strange, unusual, unexpected. So much so that as he contemplates it, he is brought into an even deeper appreciation of both God's glory and grace. And so Psalm 8 is essentially his reflections on that, a song praising Yahweh for something so intriguing and delightful and mysterious. All right, so to follow our typical procedure here, let's work through each of those three sections, but first we'll make a couple comments about the heading itself. Psalm 8, as you see there, is attributed to David, and we don't really have any reason to question that. As a young man, you will remember that he attended the flocks of sheep as a shepherd, even throughout the night as needed, and certainly he would have gazed upon the night sky and pondered the mysteries of the moon and stars. And so it's easy to see David as the composer of Psalm 8 and that it was inspired by his own awe-filled observations. And we are introduced in the heading yet to another new word as we have in Psalms past, this one, giddeth. It is also found in the headings of Psalm 81 and 84. And like other words we've come across, the meaning of this one has been lost over the centuries as well. It could be a musical tune or a reference to a particular musical instrument or maybe a ceremonial occasion. We really don't know. All right, so let's consider now the opening line of praise. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. A number of years ago, the popular Christian musician Michael W. Smith wrote a song based on the first line here, which was then picked up by Sandy Patty, who made it quite popular. I'm sure that we've all heard it. In fact, we sing that song here from time to time, and I see that Dave Stevens has selected it for today as well. And since we have become familiar with the words of the first verse because of that song primarily, you know, we probably don't ever actually pause to actually think about it all that much. And it's kind of easy to go through the motions with things that we are familiar with. So take the redundancy in the first four words, for instance. Chances are you've never really given that much thought. I hadn't. You know, we might think that it was intended, perhaps as a way to provide some emphasis. But this is not the case. In fact, that redundancy is not found in the original language. It's something that surfaces in English translations. So let's look at this. The first Lord used there is actually in the Hebrew. Anyone want to take a shot at this? It is on your homework if you work through it. It is Yahweh. Okay, and this, as you will remember, is the personal name of God used by his chosen people, the Israelites. It distinguishes him from foreign deities. And the issue then is simply this. In most English translations, it is a common practice to translate Yahweh as Lord using small caps. So if you're using the NIV or the ESV, that's probably what you'll see there. And the reason for that is explained in the introductions to your Bible. The second Lord is different. The word for that is Adonai, or Adonai, and that's a common word that refers to master or Lord, and is used to emphasize the respect that one is to give to someone who rules over them. And so in this exclamation of praise, David is simply identifying the God of Israel as the rightful ruler of the world. You know, generally speaking, Yahweh is God's name, Adonai is God's title, describes him as Lord. And so here in verse 1, David points out that Yahweh's majesty is revealed not just to Israel, but to all peoples. It is seen, as the expression there, throughout all the earth. His glory is manifested in the heavens for all to see. And the implied argument, therefore, is pretty simple. Who could possibly be higher than the one who made the heavens and the earth? Who could possibly have more power, more authority, more majesty, more glory? Who could rule over such a God? Yahweh, the God of Israel, is Lord of all. Three quick points about that. In the Old Testament, a name, whether of humans or of God, is an extension of the one who bears it. Where God chooses to place his name in the land, in the temple, on his people, there God is also. The presence of his name lays claim to divine authority wherever it dwells. Secondly, the phrase, "How majestic is your name in all the earth," as you see there, is paralleled with the following phrase, "You have set your glory above the heavens." Well, earth and heaven, of course, mark out the two most distant boundaries, if you will, from one end of creation to the other. Everything in heaven and everything on earth and everything in between, God has created it all, his name is up on it, and his majesty is revealed throughout. And thirdly, we should also note something about the word used for majesty. The Hebrew term used here is found elsewhere to describe things like a mighty ship or a powerful leader, and also stately nobles and so forth. Majesty refers to a display of power, and that display of power is impressive, it is intimidating, and it can even be imposing. It is a power that is visible and on display for all to see. And yet the response to that power, that majesty, here in Psalm 8, is not one of fear and terror, as you would expect, but adoration and amazement, real genuine amazement. All right, let's move on to the first section of the body itself, starting with the second half of verse 2. You have set your glory above the heavens, out of the mouth of babies and infants. You have established strength because of your foes to still the enemy and the avenger. If you have the NIV 2011, it'll read a little bit different. If you have the NIV 1984, it'll read a little bit different yet. The NSAV is a little bit different. And this is really, this is an interesting passage. But it does prevent a few challenges. One resource I looked at said that these two sentences are, quote, extremely hard to understand in the original Hebrew, all right? Which means that they will be difficult for translators and they'll be difficult for readers. It'll be difficult for us. And so while we may not be able to nail down everything precisely, we can, however, get a basic idea of the main gist. The general consensus, which we see reflected in both the NIV and ESV, is that David makes an abrupt transition from the theme of God's breathtaking power to the theme of powerless infants and the presumed power of God's enemies. God's power is, well, stupendous. His divine glory has been set, ordained, established above the heavens itself. Above the visible creation, it is otherworldly, and it is there for all to see. Babies and infants, you might say, are on the other end of the spectrum. They are weak, feeble, helpless. They need to be fed, cared for, protected. They are wholly dependent on others. In contrast to the great God of the cosmos, they are unimpressive, certainly not majestic by any sense of the word. One might wonder what babies could possibly do that would cause the great God of the cosmos to take any notice, much less serve his purposes in any meaningful way. Two types of children are mentioned. The ESV renders this babies and infants. The Hebrew word for babies generally refers to older babies and young toddlers. And the word for infants refers specifically to nursing babies. And the irony here is that such creatures who are so weak and powerless are used by God to silence those who presume to have power, those who are independent and proud, that is, enemies of God. Psalm 8 has a number of these ironies, these unexpected conclusions, and this is an example of one of those. The point emphasized here is not the power of the powerless babies or the powerlessness of powerful enemies. What is highlighted here is God's power. He is so mighty, His majesty is so throughout, that He can use even nursing infants to defeat nations who conspire against Him in all of their rage. This plays into what we see in the rest of the psalm, as in God creating the whole universe by the effortless work of His fingers. Remember that expression? Not only is nothing too difficult for Him, but nothing is difficult at all. The ESV renders the opening of verse 2 as out of the mouth of babies and infants, whereas the NIV says through the praise of. And this is one of those areas that is unclear in the original language, whether the word praise was intended or not. We could read into it that it was intended, given that Jesus quoted this verse during His triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and in doing so, He used the word praise. And so this actually adds another nuance to the irony here in Psalm 8. The inarticulate murmurings and babblings of vulnerable and dependent babies, in a sort of unexpected way, constitute a source of praise to their Creator. God delights in their innocence, who are set in contrast to the wicked enemies. Unlike them, infants do not presume to have independence and power. They are not proud. They do not resist the Lord. Furthermore, this Most High God, who is glorious, set above the heavens, has decreed praise from even the smallest and weakest of the creatures. Now, this should get our attention. This ties into the verses that follow regarding the seemingly insignificance of man. Even as we are to marvel at how the great infinite God of the cosmos is mindful of humans and cares for them, so should we marvel that He delights in the babbling of babies. There's something unusual, intriguing, strange about that. And all of this, you know, should stir within us a kind of bewilderment. That's the intention here. And actually, on top of that, a deep appreciation. Such praise from the cradle and nursery is more powerful than all the conspiracies of God's enemies, if for no other reason than this. In the end, the plans of the enemies will fail. Their plans to, remember Psalm 2, break their chains and throw off the moral restraints of God's law will amount to nothing. Their noise will be silenced, drowned out by the worship and praise of the righteous, including what comes from the mouths of infants. Regardless of how the wicked assert themselves, they cannot undo the evidence of God's glory on earth and in heaven. And this is something that babies testify to. The sound of children, because it represents the continuousness of the human race, and the human race itself is, of course, the subject of the next section, is indeed concrete evidence of God's eternal plan unfolding. That plan, of course, involves humans exercising kingly stewardship over the earth as representatives of God. This plan, as is God's glory, is set, ordained, established above the heavens. And the noises that come from a baby's mouth, as unintelligent as those noises may be, demonstrate to all creation that God's divine plan is being executed, and no enemy can stop it from happening. In the end, they, again, will be silenced. All right, in the next section, verses 3 and 4, David begins with awed wonder at the creative power of God displayed in the heavens, and this then causes him to reflect upon the significance of mankind. These should be familiar verses to you. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? All right, going out and marveling at the night sky and being awestruck by God's glory that is revealed in it is, to a large degree, sadly, a thing of the past. It's just not something that we do anymore. For one, our tastes as a culture have changed. Instead of appreciating the rich and natural beauty of God's creation, we are more easily drawn to the cheap and meaningless entertainment offered to us in television and movies and video games. Our appetites have been conditioned by the amusements of the modern age. We prefer over-the-top stimulation, over-the-top saturation of special effects, fast-action graphics, and so on. And so looking up at the night sky, you know, all that has a hard time competing with those sorts of things. Secondly, even if you wanted to take in the night sky, well, viewing it is not what it used to be. It is, sadly, largely been diminished by all the man-made light that is generated by our cities. Even in rural areas, the deep blackness of the night sky is washed out to some degree. And this haze lessens the brilliance of the thousands of stars that are visible, or should be visible, to the naked eye. Not to mention deep sky objects like galaxies and clusters and nebula. Even the Milky Way, truly a marvel to behold, that especially evokes a sense of breathless awe, has a cloudy, smeared appearance to it. But David had no such obstacles to contend with. He wasn't tempted to watch TV and waste his time on computer games that competed for his attention. There weren't any 850 billion gigawatts of light shooting up into the sky all around him. The deep blackness of outer space was as black could be. And the myriads of stars that populated that sky were sharp points of light radiating uncompromised brilliance. A splendor so amazing that it did indeed, it just naturally would to all inspire reverence and awe. And David marveled that God could create all this with so little effort, as he says there, with the work of his fingers, which, you know, is really a neat way of emphasizing that. I mean, it brings to mind, at least to me, something like tying your shoes. You know, it's so effortless. You don't burn many calories tying your shoes. You certainly don't break a sweat. The natural result of this, standing beneath the night sky and contemplating the glory of the universe, leaves one, as it did David, feeling a bit insignificant by its unfathomable immensity. People come and go. Nations come and go. But the moon that rises tonight will be the same moon that David wrote about here in Psalm 8. The same moon that Moses observed, and Abraham, and Adam. It's the same stars. Man is not only small in comparison, but he is also in comparison so transient, so temporary. As the scriptures say, we're like a mist. We're only here for a short time. And so David, in humble self-reflection, asks the big question. What is man? You know, he must be something, for as David points out, God is mindful of him. Remembers him, knows him, thinks of him. And furthermore, as it goes on to say, God cares for him. And at this, David marvels. Dwarfed beneath the immense expanse of the glittering heavens, David reverently says, "How great and magnificent you are, O God, and how puny we humans are by contrast." The words "son of man" refer, of course, to offspring, and David probably has in mind the babies and infants he spoke of in verse 2. Well, the big question, what is man, that stands at the center of the psalm, isn't given a comprehensive answer, nor is it addressed directly. But in the next section, verses 5 through 8, some answers are provided, and these answers are themselves another cause for awe and amazement. But before we look at those, I'd like for us to pause here for a moment and try to appreciate something. I want you to think about how David was so taken back by his view of the night sky. I want us to try to climb into that scene. You know, the psalm does a great job of helping us feel what he felt, awe and reverence, along with smallness and insignificance. But the fact is, David didn't know what he was looking at. He knew it had all been created by God, but he didn't know, for instance, anything else about that night sky or what was in it. He didn't have a clue that a handful of those stars were actually planets, like the Earth. Instead of simply points of light, they were as big as the Earth itself, like Venus and Mars. Others, like Jupiter and Saturn, were several times bigger yet. They appear small only because they are so far away. Millions of miles. If he knew that those little points of light were other worlds and how far away they were, well, he probably would have fainted in amazement. This is something we have been taught since childhood, and we seldom give the matter any thought, much less be impressed by it. It's just trivia in our brains. David also didn't know that these planets, along with the Earth, all revolve around the sun together. And that the other stars out there, the thousands and tens of thousands that he could see, are also other suns, with many, of course, having planets that revolve around them. The closest such sun or star is Alpha Centauri. David may have noticed it, but it is essentially just another one of thousands of points of light in the night sky. It is roughly the same size as our own sun, around 1 million miles across. It is 4.2 light years away. All right, and I want you to think about how fast light travels. John, 100 and...
86,000.
Very good. 186,000 miles per second. That's moving along pretty good. Now, I want you to think back 4 years ago. 4 years ago today, I gave a sermon on sanctification. Anyone remember that? I barely remembered it myself. Okay. All right. The rays that were generated from Alpha Centauri on that day back then are just now reaching the Earth, coming at us at over 670 million miles per hour. And this is the closest star. Had David known just how big these stars really are and how far away, I think his head would have just exploded. You know, he didn't have a clue. It's just amazing to think about. He was so awestruck by this and really didn't know what he was looking at. We know. All the stars that David saw and that we see belong to our galaxy, the Milky Way. Our galaxy is 100,000 light years across. 100,000 light years. Astronomers have estimated that it is populated by as many as 400 billion stars, suns like our own, many of which have planets that revolve around them. How does one even begin to grasp 100,000 light years or 400 billion solar systems? But the Milky Way is just one of many other galaxies. The closest galaxy to us outside the Milky Way, which is barely visible to the naked eye, and then only in a very dark location, and then you can only see it as a very small fuzzy spot, is Andromeda. And even in most telescopes, it is so far away that it still just looks like a fuzzy spot. It is roughly the same size as our Milky Way. It is, get this, 2 million light years away. You know, the light that we are now seeing from it was generated 2.5 million years ago. Therefore, we are seeing it as it was back then. We don't know what it looks like today. For all we know, it could have ceased to exist and we wouldn't have known. I'm amazed that David was still awestruck by the night sky, and yet really he didn't have a clue at how immense, how truly immense it really is. In a way, this should really get our attention. It should sober us. I mean, we do know. But again, it's just sort of like trivia that we store in our brains. We have far more reason to be stunned, far more reason to drop our jaws in utter amazement and worship God for His glory revealed in the heavens. Far more. Currently, scientists have estimated that there are no less than 100 billion galaxies in just the observable universe. The observable universe goes out to about 46 billion light years. That makes the distance to Andromeda at a mere 2.5 million seem like a stone's throw away. We'll let Dave Stevens convert 13 billion light years to miles, or 46 billion light years to miles. But given that we know even more than David, the true vastness and immensity of such an immeasurable universe, you know, how much more relevant is the question for us? What is man? How much more should that really, you know, dig at us? What is man that you are mindful of him? The Son of Man that you care for him? In light of all of this, part of the answer to that question is found in the following verses, in the next section, verses 5 through 8. Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands, and you have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. Not only is God mindful of man and cares for man, but even more than that, he has given him authority over the works of his hands. The why is not answered in this psalm. But we know from other scriptures that God has made and blessed the human race simply because it was his good pleasure to do so. There was no need within God that had to be met, no external pressure or anything like that. Out of his sheer grace and goodness, he freely made and blessed us and empowered us to rule on his behalf. The what is, however, answered at least partially in three statements. First, he has been made a little lower than the heavenly beings. The word heavenly beings is an interpretive translation of the Hebrew word Elohim, which means God or gods. And the Old Testament is often used to refer to multiple foreign deities worshipped by polytheistic nations. But it is also used at times to refer to the God of Israel. Between these two extremes, imaginary false gods that don't even exist, and the one true God who created everything, we find a number of other occurrences of it referring to cosmic beings who are subordinate to God, as in angels, for instance. And that is probably what is intended here. But either way, the meaning is quite clear, and it's quite profound. God has bestowed the highest possible honor on an earthly creature by creating them only a little less elevated than beings that occupy the heavenly sphere. This unique standing or status is driven home in the next part of that verse, where we find the second statement. God has crowned humans with glory and honor. In this psalm, David no doubt has the first chapters of Genesis in mind and understands that glory is a characteristic of God, and that God has conferred his glory to mankind, given him this unique status, by the divine act of making man in his own image. And all this is not something that is confined to the philosophical and the abstract. It is fleshed out, proven, worked out by the fact that God has allowed his power to be displayed through these creatures he has graciously chosen, humans, in order to extend his authority into the world. Thus, the third statement found in the parallelism of verse 6. God has given mankind dominion over his creation. They have been entrusted with the responsibility of overseeing and caring for the earth and its various creatures. And so, what is man? Well, essentially, man is God's vice regents, stewards of God's creation, deputized to work his authority. And with that responsibility, you know, they have been divinely appointed to govern on his behalf. This is part of that glory and honor that God has crowned them with, to care for and rule over God's sheep, oxen, beasts of the field, his birds, his fish, and his other sea creatures. But very important, this authority is authority that comes from God, and therefore it is limited, and man will give an account to God on how he exercised it. Everything has been placed under our feet by God, not by human power. There is nothing in the psalm to suggest that we have unchecked authority to do whatever we want with the creation that has been entrusted to us. You know, we do not have a license to exploit it for our own selfish desires and ambitions. Sharing God's image, we are called to share his loving care for all he has made. So again, what is man? Three things. He is the highest of all earthly creatures. Secondly, he has been crowned with glory and honor, made in the image of God. And thirdly, he has been assigned to serve as vice regents over God's creation, exercising wise and responsible stewardship. All right, finally, verse 9, the psalm ends as it begins in lavish praise for the Creator whose majesty permeates all that he has made. At the beginning, David's praise began by affirming the magnificence of the Creator. Here at the end, he stands in awe at the unexpected grace. It begins with unexpected power. Here it's unexpected grace that God has shown the human race. In their God-given status and responsibilities and authority, he's intrigued and he thanks the Lord for this. The point of the psalm is not really about how great the universe is or how small man is. It is about how great God is in his majesty, power, and glory, and in his grace, goodness, and benevolence. All right, well, I was hoping to have a little bit of time here to work through some of the questions on the homework, but we'd be cutting it kind of short if we did that. Let me see.
Go ahead.
All right, well, what title? I'll just hear from a few of you. What title would you give this psalm? That was one of the questions. What title would you give it? Something that's, you know, I mean, you could call it How Majestic Is Your Name, but that'd be kind of obvious. Did you come up with something a little bit more thought-provoking? Anybody?
How majestic is your name?
Okay, Tina, anybody else? All right, how about number six? How do you do with question number six? Verses 4-6 are quoted in the New Testament. I didn't want you to look it up. I wanted to see if you could recall it to mind. What book was it found in? Hebrews. How many got Hebrews? Very good. And if you got the second chapter, you get to help clean up after the deli the next time we have one. That'll be the reward for that. Now, we will exempt you from cleanup. Exempt you from cleanup. What chapter did you come up with in Hebrews? Anybody? Chapter 2, you knew it? You didn't have to look it up? All right, very good. All right, what would you say is the driving emotion or mood in the psalm? Awe, definitely. Okay, and list some truths about God that come through. Let's just brainstorm these. Fire them away. What truths about God come through? Some of these are really obvious. Sovereign. Creator. Okay.
Almighty.
Powerful.
Benevolent.
Benevolent. Yes, I'm glad that you mentioned those, because that does definitely come through in the second half. Begins with this power and kind of transitions into this. Not only is he omnipotent, but he's also omnibenevolent. He is gracious to mankind. All right, now, how would the psalm serve as a model for our own prayers and songs of worship? This one will be a lot easier than the other ones that we've done.
Focus on God.
Okay. All right.
Give thanks.
Okay. Yeah, it's very good. Okay. What's that?
Unending praise.
Unending praise. Good. Thanks, Annie. Think of the Lord's Prayer. Remember how the Lord's Prayer starts off? Hallowed be thy name. There is this sense of reverence and respect and awe. And I think Psalm 8 does a good job in trying to, you know, help us feel that, see the importance of it. I think a lot of times we just kind of rush into our prayers with, I need help with this. And we should just sort of pause and reflect upon the God that we are praying to kind of contemplate his attributes, his nature, his character. Majesty would be one that would certainly be worth thinking about when we pray. All right, any other comments on anything else on the homework? Still doing your homework okay? Still want a worksheet? I'll send a worksheet out about what about Marlon Stutzman's speech this week. Right. All right, next time, which will be the week after, I think that would be the 13th of September, we will pick it up again. We'll probably look at Psalms 9 and 10 together. If I remember right, those two, there's some speculation that those were part of one psalm at one point, if I recall. So we'll probably deal with both of those together. So at this time, while we have the children come in, we'll have the musicians come forward, and let's stand and we'll continue our time together in worship.